This is Voices from Appalachia Radio Show, sponsored by the Center for Appalachian Studies and Communities at Shepherd University. I'm Brian Staggers, and here's your host, Bianca Eisen.
Welcome to the Voices from Appalachia Radio Show. Our guest today is Emily Hilliard. Emily is the Program Director of Folk and Traditional Arts at Mid-Atlantic Arts, and was the former West Virginia State Folklorist and Founding Director of the West Virginia Folklife Program. Her writing and media work have been published by NPR, Oxford American, Southern Cultures, The Bitter Southerner, among others. She serves as the film reviews editor for the Journal of American Folklore and is a 2021 to 2022 American Folklife Center Archie Green Fellow for a project documenting the occupational culture of rural mail carriers in Central Appalachia. Her newest book, Making Our Future, Visionary Folklore and Everyday Culture in Appalachia, has been published by the University of North Carolina Press this month. Emily, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So to begin with, I'd like you to share with our listeners the meaning of the terms folklife and folklore.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the book, I kind of use them interchangeably, but I think of folklore and folklife as everyday creative expressions that are shared in community and come from a specific place. So those are things like the family recipe that you make for a special occasion, dress, songs, music, dance, material culture. And I think there's a little bit of a difference between folklore and folklife. I think folklore often has a perception of things that are the untrue or the old-timey ways. And folklife, I usually prefer as a term because I think it shows that it's living traditions and part of everyday life and doesn't have the same connotations that folklore has.
Now, even though there was legislation that was pushed back in the 70s to preserve traditions and folklore, you didn't become our first state folklorist until 2015. So as the first one to hold this position, I'd like you to talk a bit about what that job entailed working for the West Virginia Humanities Council.
Yeah, so when I first started, our really initial charge was to conduct a statewide folklife survey. So to do field work all across the state with cultural communities and traditional artists, and to document what people are doing in terms of traditional art and cultural practices, but then to also get a sense of their needs and how we as the Folklife Program could help support more of those activities and sustain those traditions into the future. So that was an ongoing project and will continue to be. And then we worked with WVU Libraries to create an archive where all of those documented materials are housed. So almost all of the materials of interviews and photos and videos and transcripts and some documents that I documented and others as well are now in that digital archive at WVU. And then the new state folklorist will add to that, and hopefully it will continue well into the future. And then we also started an apprenticeship program where mentor artists work with younger, usually younger, but not always, but less experienced practitioners to learn traditions like midwifery, forest farming, old-time music, gospel music. And then they work together for a year, and the mentor artist gets a stipend, and then they have a showcase and have to do public presentations in their own community. What else did we do? We had a Legends and Lore marker program in partnership with the Pomeroy Foundation, which there's one close by here in Middleway that commemorates the legend of Wizard Clip. So it commemorates folklife all over the state. There's one for John Henry. There's one for Mother Jones. And one for Bricktop. So they're all over the state, and communities can apply to commemorate important folk life and folk heroes and traditions in their own communities. So that's kind of a overview of what we did. There's a lot more involved, but those are some good basic points.
Can you talk to me a little bit about
How is documenting folk life and traditions, how is that beneficial to the community?
Yeah, so when I would start going into a place, I would usually have a public interest meeting. And that was to kind of present our vision of folk life as being broad and diverse and really attached to everyday life and not just the kind of stereotypical ideas of what folk life is in Appalachia. And then we would ask community members who are the important tradition bearers in your community, who are the storytellers, what are the important traditions that you have in your family or in your broader community, how do you come together as a community. So we would hear from the community first and then kind of go out and interview the people that they suggested. So in that way, it was kind of a service to document these for the communities themselves and then put it in a publicly accessible archive so the descendants of those artists and practitioners can go and listen to, you know, their grandparent in the future, hopefully. And then also just really listen to what communities need and hopefully adjust the program accordingly so we could support some of those practices.
Moving on to your book, Emily, what exactly do you mean by the title of it, Making Our Future?
Yeah, so that is something that actually a few of the practitioners that I interviewed and people in the state said, and I think there's also an Audre Lorde quote where she talks about making our future. But I think the exact quote was from a middle school student I interviewed on the steps of the state capitol during the teacher strike. And she said, you know, we should support teachers, and I'm here today because they are making our future. So it's really this kind of idea that folk life is a creative and collective act, and so is future building. I think we often get fed a narrative that the future will be shaped by, you know, the singular startup genius who will save us from climate change. But I wanted to show that communities in places like West Virginia are using folk life and expressive culture to really shape a new future for themselves. And they respond through expressive culture and develop strategies through expressive culture. And that was really evident in something like the teacher strike, where teachers were advocating for themselves and their students for better learning and working conditions. So that's really what I'm trying to capture in the title.
One critic had this to say about your book. Hilliard argues that folklore is a unifying concept that puts diverse cultural forms in conversation, as well as a framework that helps us reckon with the past, understand the present, and collectively shape the future. What do you think the critic was trying to say about your book?
It is really about kind of what I'm saying, the way communities are using folk life, which, you know, comes from a tradition which may be out of the past, is shaped in the present, and then is kind of a way that they're passing it on to the next generation in hopes that it will have a life in the future. So I think in the book, you'll see the way I look at a historical record and use that to think about the way the traditions are manifesting now in the present, and then the way communities are using those traditions, drawing on history to shape a new future for those traditions.
Now, Emily, each chapter of your book is a different narrative that focuses on a different practice or community in West Virginia, from Scott's Run to hot dogs, mm-hmm. to even video games. How did you make the decision of what to include in your book?
Yeah, that was difficult in a way because I had done so many interviews and talked to so many incredible people and worked with a lot of different communities, but I really wanted to highlight the community and collective aspect of folk life. So there were instances, you know, I would talk to a woodcarver, a dulcimer maker, but I really wanted to show the community aspect of folk life and think about that as something that was deserving of cultural stewardship. So even in the book where There's a chapter on four women songwriters. They practice this as kind of a private, singular practice. But I write about them as a tradition because there are other examples of women songwriters and writers in Appalachia, and I really consider those four women to be part of that tradition. Yeah, it was difficult to choose it in a way, but I wanted to also have an assortment. So there's foodways, there's literature, there's labor, there's material culture. So I wanted to have kind of a gamut of genres of folk life. And then there were a few things that I wasn't able to include. So I really wanted to do a chapter on Moorefield and the immigrant and refugee communities that work at the chicken processing plant. And I started to do that work right when COVID hit, and there had been outbreaks in the factory, and it just didn't seem like it was wise to continue that work during COVID. So that's something that then I was able to do a public broadcasting folkways story with Clara Hazlett on the Ethiopian and Eritrean coffee ceremony practiced by some residents in Moorefield, but I wasn't able to include that as a chapter in the book.
One of the chapters that I particularly loved that involved community was Fallout 76, because as a gamer myself, that's something I feel is often overlooked, is the community that comes along with some video games. And now you mentioned that you yourself are not a gamer.
That's right.
So what was your experience like visiting these real world places in a virtual West Virginia?
Mm-hmm. Well, that was really interesting to do field work in a digital space. And I'm not a very skilled video gamer. I think like Mario Kart is as far as I go. So I had some friends who walked me through the game. And then a gamer, John Barton, who he had been at the launch at the Greenbrier and had written about Fallout 76 from the perspective of a West Virginian in the past. He actually came to the Humanities Council one day, and we set up the projector, and he toured me through the game and did a kind of exhaustive tour of all the aspects of folk life. And then I read every entry in the Fallout 76 wiki and all the holotapes that you can find in the game. I watched Twitch streams of people playing, and also watched a group, the Homeowners Association of Fallout 76, that would tour each other through their camps that they had built in the game. I went to a poetry reading in the game. So it was pretty different from sitting knee to knee with someone with a microphone and interviewing them. But it was really interesting to see that the way the gamers were shaping this kind of narrative in the game. And really, it sparked their interest in West Virginia. And so many ended up visiting the state in real life after playing.
And that's something else that I love that you talk about in your book, is normally when people bring up West Virginia and they're taking something from the state or even the region, it's as a commodity. But what it seems like ended up resulting from the game is that people were coming and they were really appreciating the culture, appreciating Fastnacht in Helvetia?
Helvetia, yeah.
Helvetia.
Yeah. Yeah, that is, it's complicated. I do think many of the gamers have a real respect for the place. And one of them I interviewed said, when I came to West Virginia, I was kind of disappointed in the game because West Virginia was so much more, it was more mysterious and interesting than the game was able to capture, which I thought was cool. But then there's also some concern in a place like Helvetia, which is a tiny mountain town, that these Fallout 76 gamers who want to come to Fastnacht and maybe wear Fallout 76 masks at the game, at the parade, are maybe kind of overrunning the capacity of this tiny town, where it's a really real community effort to make these events happen. So I think there's a little bit of a concern in the town, but also some appreciation too.
Now, of the traditions that you did cover, because you mentioned that there were some you wished you had covered, what were your favorites that you talked about in your book?
I think that maybe my favorite chapter, just because of the research discoveries, is probably the wrestling chapter. So I write about independent pro wrestling as a West Virginia tradition. And I started going to a wrestling promotion in Madison in Logan County in the coal fields. And this is a place where the closest movie theater is about an hour drive away. And there's really not much other opportunities for entertainment. So it's really a community event when these wrestling shows happen. And they're family friendly. There's no alcohol. The wrestlers are not allowed to use profanity. And so it's really oriented for this kind of family entertainment. And so the narratives that are enacted in the wrestling ring are things that people talk about at the grocery store when they run into each other. And, oh, did you see what Huff Manley did, last Saturday? And who do you think the mysterious voice is that's threatening him over the intercom? So it really is this kind of folk narrative in the town. And then just looking at some of the historical examples of wrestling in West Virginia, I found that it really predated the founding of the state. There were brawling matches that were happening along the Ohio River when West Virginia was still Virginia. And then it was kind of attached to carnivals. And there would be wrestling matches held in armories. And afterwards, there would be a square dance. So it was always this kind of part of traditional culture in the state.
Now, when you had talked about the narratives of the wrestlers in your book, you did bring up that there were occasionally some questionable narratives that would probably not be considered politically correct. But it does raise another question, as there have been many misguided efforts in Appalachia to preserve the culture, which is usually white culture, above those of others. So I'd like you to talk about the efforts being made by folklorists when it comes to groups in the region that are African American, Native American, Asian American, and other groups that don't fit the assumed traditional demographic of Appalachian.
Right. So that was something I really felt was important that the Folklife Program do, because some of the previous conceptions of folklife in the state were pretty whitewashed. So I wanted to show the breadth and diversity of folk life in the state and all the different communities that live here in West Virginia. But then I see a lot of things happening, and it's not necessarily by folklorists or maybe folklore adjacent people like Crystal Good with Black by God, who is documenting creating a newspaper for Black West Virginians, and that centers Black voices. And she also has a folk reporter program that is hoping to train citizen journalists to go to a community meeting and report on what's happening. Other efforts like Black in Appalachia, that's not just happening in West Virginia, but across the region. Also, people like Marlon McClendon, who is outside of or in Pocahontas County. She's doing a project through the Appalachian Foodways Summit Fellowships, Media Fellowship. She is Korean American, and she's doing a photo essay on other Korean American communities in West Virginia that she grew up with. So there are a lot of people documenting these communities, particularly people of those communities who are doing that work to document their family and community stories.
Now, sometimes you are in a position where you're documenting a community that you're not directly connected to. And there's always that risk of incorporating your own bias and viewpoint when you're documenting other communities' practices. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned in your book how you use collaborative ethnography. And I would like you to talk about this methodology and how you use it to more authentically document communities.
Yeah, so this is something I learned in my folklore training, and it's really a way to make the ethnographic kind of engagement more equitable. So when I sit for an interview with someone, I come in with some things I want to talk about, and they do too, but I don't have a script. And we're kind of collectively shaping the conversation together. And I approach it as, we're both experts of our own experience. And then I'm closely listening as we're doing the interview for what the interviewee wants to talk about and going in that direction. So we're kind of guiding it mutually as a conversation. And then anytime I'm writing about, drawing from the interview to write about it or make a radio piece or something like that, or even just transcribing their words, the interviewees get to see it and then have feedback that gets incorporated back into the work. So there may be something, when you sit with an interview with someone and develop a rapport, they might confide something in you and kind of forget that it's going in an archive and could be publicly accessible. So sometimes when people see a transcript, they ask for something to be removed and not included in the archive, and we would honor that. But then also when you're writing about it, sometimes you make assumptions about things or get facts wrong. And so having that conversation really makes sure that the interviewee feels positively about how they're being represented, and also is kind of a way of fact-checking to make sure you get it right before it goes out into the world. So it's a little bit different than journalist approaches where you never show the quote before it goes out to being published. But I think it's a really important way to do work, especially when you're working with communities that aren't your own.
Now, how do you remain objective in a situation like this? Because I imagine there are times where what you're interested in sharing is true, but then the community you're documenting might feel like, oh, this doesn't reflect well on us. We don't want you to talk about this. We want you to make us look good.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if there's ever objectivity. So I don't think, I have actually never really encountered that issue. I think communities feel like they want a true representation. There are probably instances, maybe if you're working with like a CVB, where they want a more glossy representation of their community. But I was thinking, of my work in Helvetia, where I did a long kind of year-long project and got feedback that, I like kind of captured it, warts and all. So I think communities appreciate that. But it can take a lot of conversations to make sure you're getting it right. And, some folklorists in ethnographic narratives, there are instances where there's like competing interpretations between the interviewee and the folklorist, and they just will sometimes let those sit side by side. So there was one, Elaine Lawless writes about some women who are, I think they're preachers, they're religious women, and she calls them superheroes, and they really responded negatively to that. And they're like, we're not superheroes. We are just working in service of our faith and our community and our family. And she writes about that in her narrative, how they kind of reacted negatively to that. But that's how she saw them. So there are ways that you can kind of incorporate both perspectives into your writing.
That was actually one of the situations that popped into my mind as I was reading your book, when you're talking about the singer-songwriters in chapter 2, Shirley, Cora. And at one point you do comment about their shared experience, how when they talked about their skill, they would talk about themselves through someone else. Most of their work came through participating in gospel. And your observation that, not to say that they would have done it differently if they had the option, but because of the time and place, because they were constricted by their gender, that they really didn't have an alternative venue for artistic expression.
Yeah. So there's instances where there's this kind of humble, they use reported speech to kind of talk about themselves. Like they will say, there was a man at my church and he was very impressed with the way I played piano and he said this, but they would never brag about their own skills. They would kind of put it through the eyes of someone else commenting on their abilities or talents. But yeah, so those four women really kind of, they write songs as a private practice for the most part and not to publicly perform necessarily. Or if they do so, it's at their church or in service of the union, like the UMWA. and that is part of a tradition of women's writing in Appalachia, where writing and kind of keeping household accounts and family histories was an acceptable practice for women. So they kind of fall within that tradition of journal writing, and but they are really incredible songwriters, in my opinion.
Now, Emily, this is a complex time to live and work in the region of Appalachia. What do you think are the most important values that we gain from learning about our own traditions?
Well, I think one of the really important things is cross-cultural understanding, to find through lines across different cultural practices. And I think that's really valuable to think about the way historical issues and kind of forces of modern life affect our traditions is really important. So I think it just brings awareness to, you know, when you listen to an interview, maybe that was conducted 20 years ago, it really gives you a sense of what it was like to be that person and live there in that place. So there's a sort of a human empathy, I think, that can come about by listening to these interviews and understanding. So my hope is that by capturing contemporary folk life, that will be that for the future. So people can listen to these 30 years down the road and know what it was like to be a part of the teacher's strike, or be a grocery worker during the pandemic, or whatever it is, the interview that they're listening to.
Now, as we come to the end of our time together, Emily, would you like to share an excerpt from your book with us today?
I'll just read this short excerpt from the beginning. I've spent much of the past 6 years traveling in and across West Virginia, crisscrossing mountains, hollers, creeks, and rivers, along dirt roads and highways, on fieldwork trips to interview quilters, fiddlers, striking teachers, gospel singers, miniature makers, independent pro wrestlers, neon sign makers, herbalists, marble collectors, gamers, woodworkers, playwrights, pastors, turkey call makers, and more. I've been welcomed into homes, barns, churches, and workshops, and spent long afternoons around kitchen tables, sharing meals prepared by home cooks of traditional Filipino, North Indian, Greek, Swiss, and the particular amalgam of predominantly Scots-Irish, German, Native American, and African-American cuisines, now thought of as Appalachian foodways. I've eaten a lot of hot dogs and pepperoni rolls. I've attended a Lebanese Marajan festival, a Baptist singing convention, local independent professional wrestling shows, ramp suppers, and Serbian chicken blasts. Visited a Hare Krishna temple, gone two-stepping, harvested sorghum, and been a guest at a Ramadan fast-breaking dinner. I've toured farms and gardens and studios with dogs and cats trailing along as their owners shared family stories and personal accounts of their work, artistic inspiration, and on a few occasions, divine visions. I've been given several dozen fresh eggs, a handmade broom, a hand-hewn wooden bowl, a rug hooking kit, loaves of salt-rising bread, books, plants, and reel-to-reel tapes. Many of the people I've worked with I now call friends. The intimate glimpse I've been offered of this place has been entrusted to me with extreme generosity, openness, and intention.
Thank you, Emily, for sharing your wonderful book with us and for joining me here today.
Thank you so much.
If you'd like to learn more about Emily's book or her other work, you can visit her website at emilyehilliard.com. That's EmilyeHillard.com. Thank you so much for joining me, and until next week, I'm Bianca Eisen.
Voices from Appalachia Radio Show is sponsored by the Center for Appalachian Studies and Communities at Shepherd University, with the following created to enhance and develop the cultural and economic life of West Virginia and the Appalachian region. Academic programs that include an Appalachian Studies minor, an interdisciplinary BA, BS undergraduate degree, and a graduate certificate and master's degree in Appalachian Studies at Shepherd University. Celtic Roots and Global Appalachia Study Abroad and Celtic Heritage Series. The Appalachian Heritage Writers in Residence and Writers Award, which support the West Virginia Center for the Books, One Book, One West Virginia Common Read Selection. The West Virginia Fiction Competition. The Anthology of Appalachian Writers, an annual anthology featuring writing by the Heritage Writer, and poetry, fiction, creative nonfiction, essays, and photography created by Appalachian writers across the region and the world. Voices from the Misty Mountains, NEH, and West Virginia Humanities Council Teacher Institutes. Shepherd Speaks StoryCorps Project. and this radio show in cooperation with Shepherd University Public Radio Station, WSHC-FM. To learn more about our degree programs or upcoming events, visit us at our website at shepherd.edu/Appalachian or at our Facebook page, Appalachian Studies Program at Shepherd.